Oh.
Greg DeHart, welcome to the Bookshelf Conversation.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Ron. Appreciate it.
So, Max Packin, the Clown Prince of Baseball. For those who are under a certain age, as we were talking just before, they might not recognize the name, but they might recognize him if they've ever seen Bull Durham, in which he's prominently featured. And I know in the documentary he was accused a bit of overacting, but it's hard to play yourself in a movie. So for the first question is, why did you decide to do this project?
I decided to do this project because I played minor league baseball. And when I got out of baseball and I became a documentary filmmaker, I always wanted to do something about minor league baseball. I wanted to do a film about minor league baseball, but that was a really, this is a very broad subject. And then one day I remembered Max Packin and an encounter I had with him when I was pitching in the minor leagues. And I thought, wow, okay, this guy has been in the minor leagues for, at that point, probably 30 years. What better way to tell kind of the story of the minor leagues through the eyes of Max Packin? And then it subsequently turned in really to about his life and just honoring him and his life. Because I went into it with one view of Max and came out of it with a completely different view. I started thinking, because Max, as an entertainer, he had a very unique act, which was a game act. He did his entertaining during the game. And one day when I was pitching in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, he was working the game. He was entertaining during the game. And I had a couple men on base, and out comes Max Packin to the mound, flapping his arms, a huge crowd going crazy. And he made me a butt of his jokes. And that's how I went into it, like thinking, hey, you disrupt baseball games. I don't know if I like this entertainment so much. But I came out of it with a completely different view after I got to know him through his family, through his friends, through his contemporaries, through all the people that he entertained over the years, so many of the people that he entertained over the years. And he changed my view of the act that he did and what he brought to baseball.
You have a nice cross section of subjects in your book. You have his daughter, who was probably closer to him than anybody else in the film. You have some friends. You have baseball executives. How did you go about picking these people, and were they easy to find? I'm sure his
Yeah.
daughter was easy to find, but as far as the others go.
Yeah. It is a wide swath. The one criteria I had was I wanted it to be everyone who actually knew Max. Fortunately, 50 years in baseball, he knew a lot of people. And then it's whittling it down. Obviously, his daughter, we wanted someone from the family who could get share that perspective. But there were so many, going from Bob Feller, who I'd interviewed almost 20 years earlier, all the way up to, Harold Reynolds, and, people like, Bob Feller, who was with Max in the 1940s. So the players were obvious, because they, could bring a player's perspective and actually seeing him from that perspective. But also, some of the seminal moments in his life, someone like Ron Shelton, who was the director of Bull Durham, really important because it was such a turning point. It was real feather in his cap. Really important time in Max's life. And then, getting journalists like great writers like Steve Wolf, one of the great baseball writers, and Stan Hockman at the Philadelphia Inquirer for many, many years, a great writer who wrote his book. So I wanted a wide swath and, general managers also who had to hire him, like Mike Vec. As far as finding them, I've been making documentaries for a long time. So, I know how to get to people. The key is getting them to agree to do it. And in this case, pretty much everyone had such a fondness for Max. They were like on board. When and where? Where do you want to do the interview? Let's do it. I had very few people decline to be involved. So I was very, very fortunate about that.
Now, you mentioned Bob Feller. So, of course, he passed away some years ago. How long have you been working on this?
Right. So I started this about 20 years ago, and I got it to the rough cut stage. Excuse me. And I didn't like it. I wasn't happy with it. And I put it away. I just put it to the side and went on to other projects. 20 years later, all these years later, I'm doing films for a company that this was produced for, Sunstream Productions. And they said, I told them about this film, and it was the one film out there, the one project out there that got away from me, that I just hadn't finished, I wasn't happy with. I had a high standard for it. And they said, well, what if we revisit it, and what if we fund it for you? And I said, let's go. So I had several of these interviews in the can from previous, like Stan Hockman, writer, like Bob Feller, like Don Zimmer, great baseball people. So I had those interviews. And then I updated it with, some people who were still alive, and, it all kind of came together, and it really, and it worked the second time. I feel, I'm happy with it now. So, it was one of those, I started it, didn't like it, and finished it. I got to start it. I teach my daughter, finish everything you start. So I better do it myself. So
that's how it came about. Let me ask you, what didn't you like about it? What made you put it aside like that?
It felt flat to me. Over the 20 years in between, I just became a better filmmaker, to be honest with you. I had completely different perspectives. Became a better storyteller. And I think that's really the bottom line, is my ability wasn't up to the film the first time, is what I would say. Kind of like my baseball career.
And it's funny you say that, because I was just talking with a colleague of mine who is an aspiring screenwriter. And we were saying that if we look back on stuff we wrote 20, 30 years ago, we would do it differently now. We've learned more, and we would probably do things quite a bit differently. Of course, I knew of Max Patkin very basically, and especially more so because of Bull Durham. He was one of the clown princes of baseball, and you mentioned a few others in your book. Al Schacht, I remember, but Nick Altrock was one, and was there another one?
Jackie Price.
So I'm wondering, I know Al Schacht and Max were Jewish, and I'm just wondering, were either of the other two Jewish that you know of?
I'm not sure about Jackie. I don't know, to be honest with you. It's really interesting you pick up on that, because it was something that I grappled with, whether or not I was going to make a big deal about that in the film. And I decided against it. And the reason was, Max became a clown because he was teased so much as a child for his looks, it was his way of overcoming that. He kind of attacked it that way. And I wanted, his motivation to be clean. He mentioned a little bit every now and then, sometimes down in the South when he would perform in the late 40s, early 50s, that he was, he was discriminated against because he was Jewish. But it was a road that I chose not to go down. But yes, he was a proud Jewish man, and the other reason was because in interviews, he said it wasn't part of his motivation. He says, it's not part of my story. So I left it out. Mm-hmm. But yes, he was Jewish. And I just finished another film called The Symphony of the Holocaust. You bring that up, it's all very fresh right now.
A little darker turn there. In doing the research for this, you used a lot of archival footage. How are you able to find that?
You know, that was probably the hardest thing. Digging. So there were a couple archive houses that had a lot of footage. There was CBS had done several pieces on him, so CBS had very expensive footage. MLB helped me a lot. And can you? I just had someone come to my door. Ron, can you hold one sec?
Okay, but you should know
Sorry,
this is
sorry.
live, so go
Yeah, I
ahead.
know. You guys
So
see?
as we're waiting for our guest to return, it is just a coincidence that we do have today. I just received a copy of Max's. I was just filling in the time by saying that just today I got a copy of that book by Hockman and our subject here today, The Clown Prince of Baseball, just arrived in the mail today. So I'm looking forward to reading that. I do have a copy of Al Shaq's autobiography, which was written quite a while back. And I'll probably be going through that too. So we were talking about the archival footage.
Yeah, sorry. And then fortunately, Max kept a lot of stuff. He kept all his press clippings. He kept, you know, whenever he would go into a town in a small town America somewhere, and you know, he was a great story for a local newscast. So they would usually send someone out, and you know, they would capture him doing his act, kind of get the same sound bites over and over. But that was another place that I was able to find them, because Max kept them. So Max had died when I'd started this, and his daughter Joy was one of the first people I contacted, and she had all of his stuff. So not only was it there, it gave me clues as to where I could find other stuff. So it was a lot of, you know, I've done a lot of history. I used to do a lot of History Channel shows in the past, and when it was really like History Channel doing history. And so I had the skill set to dig, to, you know, go where I needed to go. And Joy helped me. And everybody I was with, you know, I asked, do you have anything? Do you have anything? Do you have anything? And then there's things like, you know, Bull Durham, you know, track that down, of course. That's easy, and expensive. So it was a little bit of everything. It comes from different sources, but fortunately, as I said, I think the biggest thing was that Max kept everything, and I had something to work with. I had a base to work with at that point.
So, did he ever actually perform for the Durham Bulls?
Yes, he did. He played. He performed for every minor league team that was out there when he was alive and performing. I mean, that's what he did. I mean, well, when he first broke in, there were 400 teams in the minor leagues. So once he got into like the 80s and 90s, you know, he just made the circuit. He made the circuit. Yes, I do believe he was in Durham. Yes.
And you
Yeah.
mentioned he performed at one point more than 5,000 consecutive games. That's amazing.
Isn't that, you know, that was the thing that struck me. It really always stuck with me. 50 years, 5,000 consecutive performances without once missing a performance. And he wasn't, and Don Zimmer talks about this in the film, you know, he wasn't like a team where you go in and you're there for 3 or 4 days and then you go to the next stop, right? Every night he was in a different town. So he would perform games time 7:30. He'd be out of there by the late innings. He's in his car or hustling to the airport to get to the next town to perform the next night. And he never missed a performance. And ironically, his career ends when he's not even at a performance. He's in at Fenway Park late in his career, wanting to see he was going to see his good buddy Johnny Pesce at Fenway, and before the game he walks up the steps of Fenway, the dugout steps up onto the field, and he trips and twists his ankle so bad that he can't perform the next night up in Connecticut. But this longevity thing is just, it's remarkable.
Now, we know the toll that a regular season takes on regular players. And this had a dramatic impact on his own personal life. He married a very attractive woman, as we see in the movie, but there were problems there, and a really big problem. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, he really struggled with, once he finally met someone that he wanted to marry. She was beautiful, a beautiful woman. But he still had to be on the road. He needed to be on the road. So he would leave her for long periods of time, and got to the point where she cheated on him. And he confronted her during the off season, and she sadly had a problem with alcohol, and she attacked him with a hammer and split his skull open. This is during the winter up in, you know, outside of Philadelphia, snow on the ground, and he ran outside and blood in the snow, and his daughter, who was just a little child, had to get in between them. His daughter Joy, who's just a fantastic person, she had to break it up and call the police and call the ambulances. So really, you know, he had a tragic personal life. He really did. He had a lot of demons, and it always went back to the way he was teased as a child because of his looks. He was tall and lanky and very kind of odd looking. And that's what he used to make his money, to make his livelihood, was he used his looks, because he was a clown prince of baseball, but he wasn't in a clown makeup or anything like that. It was just his face. But yeah, he had this just awful ordeal with his wife, who, you know, was so troubled that when on her 50th birthday, she committed suicide. So tragedy, always, it was never real happy during the off season for him, sadly.
Now, you say he needed to be on the road. Did he need it financially, or did he need it for his sense of self? Because you mentioned that because he was funny looking, he used that. And I think a lot of comedians use their experiences in childhood, they use humor as a defense mechanism. And I'm wondering, I mean, it sounds like that's part of his persona.
You know, Ron, you're right on. He is in a lot of ways the classic clown story, right? You're hiding your pain by making people laugh at you, or with you. So yes, that was definitely, he needed the laughter. And to a person in our film, they all agreed with that. You know, it fueled, Mike Vec talks about how it fueled him to the next stop, just to get that laughter for his self-confidence, for his self-esteem. And, you know, he made himself the butt of the jokes. He was, you know, laugh at me, with me and at me. I want you to laugh at me.
But he was controlling that. He was controlling that in a way.
Indeed. Yes, he was. So it soothed him. He needed the laughter, like the classic kind of clown story, which is the sadness, you know, behind Max. But that, you know, translates into, you know, the profession that he does. And yes, he needed the money. It was how he survived, and he made a decent living, and he had a daughter to support, and at one point a wife to support. But yeah, he's, you know, in a lot of ways, a kind of a tragic figure. And always, you know, as from a selfish standpoint, as a filmmaker, it's an interesting story. That's for sure.
Now, obviously, you shot a lot more than we see in the film. Talk a little about the editing process and how difficult it is to make a decision. I mean, you want to include everything, but you can't. So how do you go about winnowing down did you shoot this on film, or did you shoot this digitally?
Shot it. Well, the first round was shot on tape, and 20 years ago on Betacam tape. Uh-huh. But no, then we shot now on on 4K digital, the interviews. But I mean, as far as the formats, I mean, there's everything in there because we cover a scope of 50 years. So there's 8 millimeter film, 16 millimeter film, 3/4 inch tape, Betacam tape, di mini digital tape, all the way up to 4K. So we got it all covered in this one. As far as as far as the editing process, this I always wanted to do, it made sense to do it chronologically. So once you have that kind of format down, okay, I'm gonna take this year to year to year, decade by decade, because it shows how he changes. It shows how the country's changing all around him. But his gig, his act isn't changing. So the editing process, yes, most of what we shot is on the cutting floor, right? Cutting room floor. So it's just a matter of, what feels right, what doesn't feel right. And there weren't, with other films, we call it, once you get a big first rough cut, which is, like 3 hours long, and then it's like, okay, now we got to kind of start what we say, killing babies at this point, because you fall in love with everything, right? But this one wasn't hard, as some others. And we're also limited to, there was a finite amount of stuff with him. So on the field, and it was repetitive, it was repetitive because it was the same act every night. So how do you do that? It's going to get boring if you're doing it over and over and over again. So when you're weaving him as a performer in his professional life, it all came together fairly well the second time. The biggest difference between when I first started it and then what ended up was I'd always tried to stay away from this, but my editor and good friend was always pushing me, why don't you do this through your voice, through your voice, through your voice? And I always resisted that. I've never wanted to put myself in any of my films. It's not about me. But because it started with me on the mound when I saw him, I was finally kind of convinced, and I started to try it. And once I wrote it in my voice, it made the editing process easier. So that was helpful also. Yeah, if that makes sense.
Well, one thing that I don't remember if it was addressed in the film, as you can see, I'm wearing an Expos hat.
Yes, I
I
do.
try to tailor my hats to the subject and then the person I'm interviewing. Max wore an Expos hat, and he wore some sort of knockoff Mets uniform. How did that decision come about? Because that seemed a fairly standard thing later in his career.
Yeah. So the Expos hat kind of came and went, right? And he, as far as the Mets uniform, he liked the way it looked. And that was really the bottom line. He liked the way it looked. He was from outside of Philly. He was a Philly guy. And his home, he's from Reading, so that's the now AAA. It was AA at one point, minor league team for the Phillies. So there were times where he would might maybe have a Philly hat on too, but the uniform always stayed the same, with on the back the question mark on the back, right? So the expo, I could never find any of archival footage or interviews with him where he talked about that particular cap. My guess is he just liked the way it looked.
The handsome
I don't think he
piece
had
of,
a particular affinity towards it. Yeah.
yeah, it's a handsome piece of finery. So, quickly, as we're running out of time, the process of what do you do with it now? It's premiering in a couple of weeks, I think, the
Yep.
29th. What do you
29th.
do? What do you do with this? Do you go to film festivals? Do you air it on television? What do you do with it?
So it's on a new streaming service. This is one of the first films kicking off a very brand new streaming service. It's been sold from the very beginning. Sunstream.com, two N's in sun. And there it is, sunstreet.com. And we launch it on the 29th. On the 28th, we're doing our world premiere at the Reno Aces baseball game in Reno, the AAA affiliate of the Tampa Bay Rays. Sunstream Productions and their streaming service is based out of Reno. And that's where it's going to live. Whether we do, we'll probably take it to some film festivals, like, the Hall of Fame has a festival sometime, mm-hmm. A film festival and that kind of thing. But no, it lives on sunstream.com, and that's where we want people to go. And to $5, you can watch the film. $5.99, you can watch the film.
Well, I'm just thinking that, describing Max the way you do, I think he'd be very happy with what you've come up with. And we've been talking with Greg DeHart, who is the writer and editor for Max Patkin, the Clown Prince of Baseball. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
I appreciate it, Ron. Thank you so much.